So we're going to be looking at John 6, but I'm just going to explain this briefly because I feel like otherwise we're going to get distracted. So the world's most uninspiring story. Somebody said, I can't wait to hear a story about this in a preach. I cut my finger. I was screwing a leg onto a cooker and it had a sharp stainless steel edge and I cut my finger. And I went to A&E and I thought they'd just bandage it. And they said, you've just nipped the tendon, so you'll probably just need to have minor surgery. So I just went across to St. John's. And to be honest, I'm totally fine now. It's all sorted. My predominant emotion is embarrassment. not only because I think the nurses gave me an extra big bandage to further that, but I was sitting in a room for the day surgery, sort of waiting. And you've got some impressive stories there, you know what I mean? I noted that they were all middle-aged guys, 50s and 60s, with bandages on their fingers. And, you know, there were stories of chainsaws and power tools. And of course, you're sharing your stories. They said, what did you do? And I said, I screwed a leg onto a cooker. And it just cut my finger. And anyway, so that's what happened. I don't know, do you ever feel like your story isn't as impressive as everybody else's? No, okay, fine. I sometimes feel that. I don't know, even like listening to those amazing baptism stories last week, if you were here, just incredible stories of lives transformed. And all of us have a story of lives transformed. Every story is special. But sometimes I do find myself comparing myself to other people's stories. And the thing I love about John's gospel, which we're going to be reading from today, is that John doesn't really make it about individual stories. He does tell individual stories, but he makes it about Jesus. And all the way through, he's carefully editing his material to point to Jesus. So we've been looking at these things called signs, which point to Jesus. So John unashamedly removes details that the other gospel writers include. So we're going to be looking at the story of Jesus walking on the water. What's the bit you know about Jesus walking on the water? It's probably that Peter came out of the boat and walked to him. Does John mention that at all? No. That's a bit awkward when your best friend, his story doesn't make it into your cut. But John is saying, you know, I could just imagine the conversation. I'm saying, so Pete, can we have a quick word? I'm sorry, your bit didn't make the final cut on my gospel. Because I want to make it about Jesus, not about your response to Jesus. So this will signpost us to Jesus today. So today's passage is the fifth sign in the book of John that we've been working through. And it's another moment designed to help us see Jesus clearly. And we've read this verse many times in John 20, where it says, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Why is it written? So that if you're not a believer, you might believe. But do you know that word believe, as it's written there, it doesn't just mean if you don't believe, believe. It also means so that you may continue believing. So here's what happens as we read John's gospel and as we read our verses today, that our faith, if you're a Christian here today, will be strengthened. And hopefully you will love Jesus more as you read these verses and you'll feel even more deeply engaged in what it is to be a follower of Jesus. And it's a good time to be reminded of that. I'm so encouraged that the Everyone Edinburgh campaign is kicking off and you've got the Gospels on your chairs. The idea of these is that you could post one of these into every home on your street and every small group could fill its whole neighborhood. And around this church building, we'll send teams out to put one in every letterbox. We want to cover the whole of Edinburgh across many churches in this next season. So that's kind of what we want to do because we want people who don't believe to believe. But let's read from John chapter 6, verses 14 to 24 about the story of Jesus walking on the water. After the people saw the sign Jesus performed, they began to say, surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world. Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. When evening came, his disciples went down to the lake, where they got into a boat and set off across the lake for Capernaum. By now it was dark, and Jesus had not yet joined them. A strong wind was blowing, and the waters grew rough. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water, and they were frightened. But he said to them, "It is I, don't be afraid." Then they were willing to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. The next day, the crowd that had stayed on the opposite shore of the lake realized that only one boat had been there and that Jesus had not entered it with his disciples, but they had gone away alone. Then some boats from Tiberias landed near the place where the people had eaten the bread after the Lord had given thanks. Once the crowd realized that neither Jesus nor his disciples were there, they got into the boats and went to Capernaum in search of Jesus. This is John's fifth sign that he gives us to direct us to Jesus, and it's a journey of seeing who he is. Throughout his gospel, there's a contrast between the crowds who see a bit of everything of what Jesus is doing and the disciples who see up close, and they get the deeper revelation. So this story begins and ends with the crowds, but in the middle, you get these 12 disciples in a boat who see Jesus walking on the water. John's signs in John's gospel do the same work as the parables do in the other gospels. They help people to see who want to see. But those who are just a bit casual and looking from a distance, it seems to make things a little bit harder. Has anybody here been watching the Celebrity Traitors? Anybody willing to confess? Yeah, okay. Some 7 million people are, so I'm guessing about like 1 in 10 of us is probably watching it. And if you haven't seen it, it's a very simple concept. It's like a reality TV show based on a murder mystery game. And you've got traitors who do the murdering, and you've got the faithfuls who are trying to figure out who the murderer is. And when this concept was first aired to TV producers, the TV producers said, "Well, this will never work. What a boring concept." Because the audience, the TV audience, they get to know exactly who the traitors are from the start. And the TV people say, "Well, this is boring. There's nothing to figure out." But the whole fascination of watching it is that you know everything as the viewer, the TV viewer, but you're watching these people who are totally clueless, making all these working assumptions. We think, that's total. How are you not seeing this? How are you not seeing that they are clearly a traitor? But that's what makes it engaging and compelling and fun. This is what John does in his gospel. He's already told, he said, that you might know that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and you might have life in his name. He said, that's true. What we're working out in these verses is how these hapless disciples and the crowds are coming to terms with it, and they're wrestling with it, and they don't see it, and then they see it. And by the end of this story, you think, finally, they're getting it. And that helps us on our journey of faith, because we relate to their struggles, am I right? We relate to the fact we don't always see Jesus as clearly as we should. And their struggles help us. They become a mirror for our own faith journey. How will we respond to what is being revealed? So let me ask you today, how do you see him? In this passage, this sign points to three things about Jesus. Firstly, that he's the light in the darkness. Secondly, that he's the king over creation. And thirdly, that he is the Lord of peace in our chaos. And just as he came to those disciples in their storm, he comes to us today through his word and by his spirit. And later on, we'll have a time to freshly receive his presence into our lives, as well as his word, as we can pray for one another, for the reality of his presence in our lives. But let's go through these three things that are being pointed to. That firstly, John is pointing us to Jesus being light in our darkness. So verse 17, you might think this is a throwaway comment, but John never makes throwaway comments. He says, "By now it was dark, and Jesus had not yet joined them. When John wrote this, he wasn't just scratching his head saying, so what time of day was it again? Was it morning or afternoon or was it evening? No, he's not really interested in the time of day. It was the evening, it was nighttime, but in John's gospel, whenever darkness comes up, he's not just talking about the time of day, he's talking about the confusion and darkness of our souls and of the human race. John's gospel is full of layers and connections. Darkness for him isn't just about sunlight, it's a spiritual condition. He links the absence of Jesus in this verse with the presence of darkness. When Jesus is not yet present, there's confusion, fear, and uncertainty. In John's world, darkness means more than low visibility. It's when we can't see clearly, when faith feels dim, and when hope seems far away. And yet, right there in the middle of the darkness, Jesus comes. The light cannot be overcome. You see in John 1, the light shines in the darkness and the darkness has not overcome it. In John 3, it says, light has come into the world, but people love darkness instead of light. We read about Judas, that when he betrayed Jesus, he went out into the night. He left the place of clarity and went to the place of confusion. We read about Nicodemus as he struggled to come to terms with who Jesus was. He came to Jesus at night. John is making indicative comments. So at the start of the story, John is setting us up. Jesus isn't present, it's dark. But Jesus is not yet with them because he is going to be. So we're going to get ready. Jesus is going to be. He will be there. When I was 10 years old, I changed school, and in one of the early weeks, one of our teachers, he was a good teacher, he said, boys, we're going to go for a cross-country run today, and we went up onto a hillside on the South Downs, and he was a good teacher. Cross-country was never really anything that 10-year-old boys enjoy, so he just said, as soon as we got off the minibus, he said, right, guys, I want you back at the bus at 3:30, go and do your own thing. Explore, enjoy. So we all went off. We just ran all over the place. And I got chatting to a friend, and we just started walking. Sort of late on in the afternoon, my friend sort of saw another friend. He just ran off somewhere. And I thought, oh, I can't be bothered to run over there. So I just started walking down the hill by myself. And then as it got closer to 3:30, I thought, where am I? And I had no concept of where I was. I'd never been to this place before, and I thought I was walking down towards where the minibus was, but there wasn't a car park there or a minibus. And so I started to increasingly panic as it came to 3:30, 3:35, 3:40. The teacher had been very clear, the bus won't wait. So I started to panic. I started running this way and that way, and then I just stood there. So this couple walking their dog saw this little boy, me. They said, can we help at all? Being the youngest of four, I said, no, I'm fine. Nobody helps the youngest ever, right? So I said, I'm fine. Inside, I was melting. I thought, what is going to happen? I thought, well, hopefully at some point, my mum and dad will realize I'm not home and they'll figure out what's happened. In that moment, I heard the unmistakable sound of a teacher's PE whistle. And 5 minutes later, I was running towards it at full pelt to the slow hand clap of all my friends at school and to a teacher saying, come on, Hudson, you made us late. I was safe. I was home. In this story, I mean, that's a heartwarming story, am I right? But in this story, Jesus isn't pictured on the shore blowing the whistle saying, hey guys, you're lost at sea, come over here. He's pictured coming to them. He's going to come and help them in the middle of their storm when they're totally lost. He's not shouting at them from the shore, but he is coming to them. If you're in a dark place today, here's the hope that Jesus comes to you. The darkness you feel isn't random. It's the backdrop against which the light of the world is about to appear in your life. That's the first thing. He's the light of the darkness. Here's the second thing. He's the king of creation. So we read these verses at the start. After the people saw the sign Jesus performed, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world." Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. And yet then in a few moments, they see him walking on the water towards them. They all want to make him king, but Jesus, we note, will never be made king on their terms. He walks away. He'll never be made king on our terms. We join this story at the start, and the 5,000 have just been fed with supernatural bread, the previous sign. They loved what he'd done with the bread, wouldn't you? Politicians are usually elected on who makes the biggest promises and who gives out the best gifts. And Jesus is pictured handing out free food to the masses. Who wouldn't want him to be king? If he can do that with bread, what could he do to the Roman Empire? Let's make him king. It's easy to smile at that shallow motive, but don't we all do that same thing sometimes? Lord, if you would just get me through this exam that I didn't revise for, I'll start praying properly every day from now on. Lord, if you help this boy or this girl to notice me that I'm interested in, then we'll definitely give you the glory. Lord, if you help me pay this bill this month, then I'll definitely be worshipping you more wholeheartedly from now on. Lord, if you help me win the lottery, I'll definitely tithe. So often we want Jesus to reign in our lives, but we want him to do it on our terms. Lord, this is what we need from a king. And it's helpful to see at the very start of this story, Jesus detaches from a human view of what kingship looks like. And he says, no, I'm going to show you what a king looks like. And it's not what you think it is. And that's going to end with Jesus dying on a cross for our sin and coming to life, because that's what this kind of king does. He doesn't do it on our human terms. He does it based on his plan and purpose. He reveals himself not just as the giver of bread, but as the one who commands creation itself, the one who walks where only God can walk. To the crowd, he's the source of provision. To the disciples, he becomes Lord of everything. You might be wondering, why did they start calling him a prophet? Do you ever wonder questions like that when you start reading the Bible? They said, look, oh, he's the prophet. And you kind of think maybe that's just what they did in those days, you know. But no, it was deeply rooted in Old Testament history. Jesus had just multiplied bread in the wilderness. Who else had done that in Old Testament history, in Jewish history? Moses, right? Moses on the desert floor. He'd made manna for 40 years, supernatural bread. And he had made a promise to Israel back in that day in Deuteronomy chapter 18. Deuteronomy is talking to them about the future. He says, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your fellow Israelites. You must listen to him." So what's happening after the feeding of the 5,000? They're elbowing one another. They're saying, is it him? Is it the prophet? And so they say, it's the prophet. Let's make him king. He's clearly the new Moses. He's the bread guy. But John shows us something even greater in the verses we read today. You see, following the Moses theme that they're thinking about, what else did Moses do? He stretched out his hand over a sea and he walked right through the middle of it, leading the people of God through to safety from the slavery of Egypt. Now Jesus comes in the line of the prophets, And he does a miracle involving crossing water. Crossing water was a miracle power. It was a prophet thing. Joshua, Elijah, Elisha also did it too. But here's the difference. Jesus didn't part the water and walk through it. He walked on top of it. How cool is that? I mean, it'd be cool to open up the water, wouldn't it, and walk through it. You think, well, there's a miracle. To walk on it. Only God can do that. He doesn't need the waters to make way for him. Creation itself carries him. He defies natural law because he's the creator God who made natural laws. Both Psalm 66 and Psalm 77 reflect on Israel crossing through on dry land. It says, he turned the sea into dry land and he rules forever by his power. In Psalm 77, it says, your path led through the sea, your way through the mighty waters, though your footprints were not seen. John's hinting for us. He's showing us. He's saying, this is who Jesus is. He's the Lord who shepherds his people, Israel, through the water. And he does it by walking on the water in his great power. He's not another prophet like Moses. And he pushes away from just being the next Moses. He's greater than that. He's not just Israel's ruler, but he's king over all creation. And then we read this beautiful line about their response. It says, then they were willing to take him into the boat. Jesus didn't actually need their boat. In fact, Mark's gospel says that Jesus was just going to walk past. And they kind of engaged him. And they allowed him into the boat. But they needed to come to terms with who he was. It says they were afraid. They needed to receive a new understanding of who he really is. As John said in his introduction to this gospel, he says, we've seen his glory, the glory of the one and only. I want to suggest this is one of those glory moments that they said, I think we've seen something we didn't know about Jesus before. Are you seeing things you didn't know about Jesus before? That's the life of a disciple. So he's the light in the darkness. He's the king of creation. Here's the third sign we see in this, that he's the Lord of peace in the chaos. Let's read verses 18 to 21 again. It says, a strong wind was blowing and the waters grew rough. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water, and they were frightened. But he said to them, it is I, don't be afraid. Then they were willing to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. In the Bible, whenever you read about seas or oceans, it usually has a negative connotation. It's a symbol of chaos and danger. In the days before the seabed could be mapped or satellite navigation could tell you where you were, it was a treacherous place. And this sea represents an unknown, uncontrollable, threatening place. That's why in Revelation chapter 21, at the end of all things, when the fullness of the new creation is there, it says there will be no more sea. It's not that God doesn't like beaches as much as the rest of us. It's this that he's saying, all of that chaos of the uncertainty of the things in this world will be no more. Isn't that great news? When new creation comes. The disciples have rowed 3 or 4 miles, halfway across an 8-mile lake. They're about as far from land as they can be. The Sea of Galilee, surrounded by steep hills, is famous for sudden violent storms. And now, caught in one, they're doing everything they can. Mark's gospel says they were straining at the oars. They were not making headway. Things were not going well. They were exhausted. It's a picture for us of human effort at its limit, exhausted, anxious, and stuck. And right there in the middle of the darkness and chaos, Jesus comes to them. walking on the water. But let's think for a moment. This imagery that John uses to describe this incident, does it echo something anywhere else? There's darkness, there's chaos, and the wind is blowing across the face of the waters. What does that sound like? Genesis chapter 1, creation. The Spirit of God, the breath of God, the wind of God hovering over the face of the deep waters. What's the next thing that happens in creation? And God said, let there be light. John is setting us up for a creation moment, a revelation. So we're expecting, oh, what is going to happen? It's dark. It's windy. There's a storm. It's confusion. It's chaos. This is the disciples' let there be light moment when Jesus comes across the lake and he said, it's me. It's me. Don't be afraid. He says, it is I, don't be afraid. In Greek, the word is ego eimi. I think I've said that right. Literally, that word, those words mean I am. It's exactly the same expression in other contexts where Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. I am the bread of life. I am the true vine. In all of those contexts, it's a reference to his divinity. Before Abraham was born, I am. His pre-existence before even Abraham in heaven itself. In this moment, the translators rightly kind of conclude, I don't think Jesus is doing a main teaching here. He's reassuring some disciples by telling them who he is. So they translate it, it's I, it's I. But as the reader, as those watching the Traitors TV set, we're looking, we're thinking, I know what he's doing there. He's saying, it is I. He's reassuring them. But we know he's also saying, I am. I am has the control over all of creation and all of the waves. I am is the one who ultimately is God. He comes with the familiarity of a friend, but all the resources of God to help them in their moment of need. The one who spoke from the burning bush is speaking to them in the middle of a lake and walking on the waves. This is who Jesus is. In the Old Testament, there was three offices, prophet, priest, and king. Jesus, even in this story, fulfills all of those three things. He's king of creation. He's the prophet who makes the bread and walks on the water. But he's also the priest who mediates for his people. He comes to them. He doesn't wait for them to come to him. He comes to them in their moment of need. Stepping into their storm, John says they were willing to take Jesus into his boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore. What a great picture of salvation. The moment you accept Jesus into your life, the straining, the rowing, the trying to do it by yourself, the trying to get to heaven, the trying to please God in your own effort, all of that ends. The journey has finished. It's done. We love that phrase in our culture these days. Everyone says it, don't they? Oh, we're on a journey. We're on a journey. Everyone's on a journey these days. I was chatting to some Mormons who are a different religion a few years ago, and we were having a debate, you know, just a very nice conversation, actually, but I knew where they were trying to get to with me, and they said, Dan, would you pray with us? And would, you know, I think none of us know everything, right? Would you pray that God will show you more truth? And I knew what they were getting at, and so I answered this way. I said, no, I can't pray that because I've received Jesus, who is the way, the truth, and the life. I know everything there is to know about truth because I've received truth into my life. The journey has ended with Jesus coming into my life in terms of my salvation. Now, as a disciple, I walk on with him hand in hand, but the job of salvation has been done. And it has for you if you have accepted Jesus into your boat today. A journey that began with fear and self-effort ends in peace and rest. That's what he does. He brings our human striving to an end. Religion says, do. Jesus says, done. Done. The struggle ends with him. That's at the heart of this sign. When you're at your limit and the storm is at its strongest, when you can't row any further, he comes. The great I am steps into your chaos and brings peace in the person of Jesus. So let me ask you some questions as we respond to this one who is light of the world, who is the king of creation, and the one who comes to us. Maybe you're not yet a Christian here today. We're so glad you're here. We're so glad that you're on a journey. Do you hear him saying to you through everything in this meeting, it's me, it's I'm coming to you. He's come to you. He's here to bring peace and forgiveness and grace. Your confusion, your dark night of the soul can be made clear and your striving can cease today. But you must be willing to invite him into your boat and allow him to be the Lord of your life. Oh, thank you. It is an amazing story. If you're a Christian here today, I want to encourage you into deeper things. See, Jesus isn't just the provider. He loves to provide, and he's done that for me, and he does it for you. We love to come to Jesus with our shopping lists. Lord, would you do this? Would you help this person? Would you do this in my life? Would you provide for me? Would you give me the new job? He will provide for all of our needs. He's promised to do that. But more than provision, he wants to bring his presence into your life. He wants to bring presence into the middle of your challenges. Do you hear him saying to you today, again, it's me. I am. I am enough for you. The storm can rage around you, but he is enough for you. And for us as a church, you know, so often we can tend to define success by whether God's answering our prayers or not. That's tend to help. So if we've got enough bread, then things are going well. And if we don't have enough bread, then clearly something's not right here. This story teaches us that followers of Jesus can expect to see the miracles of Jesus and the provision of Jesus, but they can also expect to find themselves lost in the middle of a storm sometimes. And Jesus does that deliberately so that they will experience his presence and his person in a greater measure. He's just as present there, even when the visibility is poor. As a church, we're moving into this new season where we have a community here in Gilmore Place and one in the north of Edinburgh. Those guys, many of them are not here this morning because they're now meeting on Sunday afternoons every fortnight. That will probably be going more regular in 2026. It can feel choppy sometimes. Not all of that is bread on a plate. Not all of that is, well, that's great, isn't it? Happy days. No, that can feel challenging. It can feel challenging because suddenly we see our serving teams have emptied out and we need apparently 11 new kids workers to join our teams in Gilmore Place. You think, oh, where did they go? Oh, it's because they're now helping start a new church in the north of Edinburgh. And that's really exciting, but it's challenging. It's choppy. Perhaps more personally, I was chatting to somebody and they were just honest. They said, Dan, I love this whole communities thing, but I've got to say that pretty much all of my friends are now in a different place than me. I thought, well, that's hard. I thought, yeah, I miss some of those guys too when they're not here. We're still one church, but in two places. That's hard, but what's the answer to these things? You see, as elders, we can do a bit of wave management. We can try and bail out some water now and then to make things a little bit easier, a bit more bearable. But where does peace come from? Jesus, right? It's Jesus coming into your life and into the midst of our church in these moments. And we say, Jesus, I just need your peace. I need the Lord of peace to come into my life in this moment. We don't respond with panic, but we respond by looking to the one who says, it's me. He's what we need. Welcome him with your questions, your worries, and your weariness. You know, the story of Gideon in the Old Testament in Judges 6 is one of an anxious man who's full of doubts and many questions. It's amazing just how many. He pushes God's patience, asking for fleeces and signs, and yet God comes to him. And you know what? One of God's covenant names in the Bible is revealed to Gideon in that moment, Jehovah Shalom. It's in the midst of the questioning. It's in the midst of, well, Lord, who, me, what? No, not. I'm not sure about this. God says, I am your peace. That's what Abraham needed. That's what Gideon needed. And that's what you and I need too. And what power it is. It's mind-blowing, as Emma said earlier, that he who was and is to come is in your boat. The same Lord of peace walks on water, and he gets in your boat whenever you ask him. And do you know, one day, this same Jesus is going to step into history again. Not onto a lake, but he'll step through the clouds. And every storm will cease forever. And the sea of chaos will finally be still. And all who have welcomed him into their boat will see him face to face. It will be like that whistle that I heard on the South Downs that day, because the Bible says there's going to be a trumpet sound as Jesus calls all those who are him to be with him forever. The Savior calling us home. And that's why we want everyone in Edinburgh to meet this Jesus, who's the light in the darkness, the king over creation, and the peace in our chaos. We want every home to receive one of these gospels, and we want every heart to hear this invitation. So let me ask you this question today. Will you let him into your boat? Not just as the giver of bread, but as the Lord of peace. While you keep him on the outside, the storm rages on. Invite him in and experience his calm. Let's pray together. Just want us to have a moment to experience his peace, which may be just sitting here quietly for a moment. Just ask him in your own heart now to come into your boat. Lord Jesus, thank you that you come to us not only when the sea is calm, but when the waves are high and the night feels long. Thank you that you still say, it is I, don't be afraid. We open our hearts to you now. Come into our boat again, Lord, into our worries, our homes, our city, our church. We welcome you as the light in our darkness, the King of all creation, the Prince of Peace in the middle of our chaos. Where we've been striving, help us rest. Where we've been anxious, speak your calm. where we've been far from you, draw us close. Fill us with your Spirit's peace, peace that passes understanding, peace that guards our hearts and minds in you. We receive it now, Lord, your presence, your peace, and your power. Amen.
You may just need to say to someone either they're here today or you need to send them a message or chat in your small group this week and say, I need Jesus with me. I need to know he's with me. I need to be opening myself to him, inviting him in. I want to encourage you to make that response. This is maybe for you, you've never believed in Jesus, never trusted him. He's never been the captain of your boat. May just be you're just a believer. You're just like me. You just feel like the day's a good day, I've got peace. The day's a bad guy, I've not got peace. We need more of Jesus. That's what we're meant to do as his followers. I need more of him. So I really want to encourage you. Just have that conversation with yourself if you need to. And if you are saying, no, I really need help with that, to step in, to invite him to step in, we'd love to help you with that, as with the people on our Connect desk. And we've got ways in which we can help you explore that over time. But he's calling to you today and he wants you to respond.